Is what am I is a teaching that the Buddha has discovered and proclaimed. And so these are the things that everyone should remember. Yeah, these are the things that will lead to the future of Buddhism being kind of Buddhism surviving in the future, being prosperous in the future. This is kind of critical for bringing Buddhism forward. And there's many different ways of looking at this, but there's only one of these of the places the Buddha says we should remember the Dhamma of India that he taught. Sometimes it talks about the Four Noble Truths. But here is a set of factors that is also mentioned in a number of places, which is probably the most common way that the Buddha summarizes his teachings. And these are known as the 37 Bodhipakkhiya Dhammas, 37 aids to awakening. Bodhipakkhiya Dhamma, Bodhi means awakening. Pakkhiya is signs, they are on the side of awakening, that's why they become aids to awakening. Yeah? They are on the side of awakening. Pakkha is also the wing of a bird, because it's the side of a bird. And Dhamma is quality or factor or something like that. So the 37 Bodhipakkhiya Dhamma. And what are these 37? And they are the four applications of mindfulness, or the four focuses of mindfulness, something like that, four establishments of mindfulness. Certainly not the four foundations of mindfulness. We can all agree on that, right? Can we? I don't know. To me, I can talk about mindfulness, if you like. Foundational mindfulness is not quite right, because foundational mindfulness means that it is that which gives rise to mindfulness. It is the foundation, the support for mindfulness. But actually, the four satipatthanas mean not the four foundations in such a way, but it means is really the four ways of using mindfulness. So it's more like the application, how to apply mindfulness is a more correct way of translating this as far as I can see. And then we have the four right efforts, yeah? A very common set in the suttas. And we have the four idhipadas, the four factors for spiritual power, something like that. And the five faculties, the five powers, the seven factors of awakening, and finally the noble eightfold path. Yes, Peter. Come to me in a second. Yeah. So these are the 37 factors. The 37 aids to awakening. And the first thing about this, the Buddha says that he had discovered this. Yeah? But actually, the first thing about this is that what people notice about them is that they all have to do with the path. Yeah? Buddhism is all about the practice, it's all about being pragmatic and practical. All of these things concern the thing that we do as Buddhists, having made progress on the path. But there's nothing there that is really philosophical now. Yeah? That is the first thing that is very interesting about this 37. It is not just practical, and I'll show you that in a second, because everything that is practical must have a context. It doesn't make any sense to say practice a path unless you know where you're going and where you're coming from. It needs to be some kind of theoretical context, any kind of path. But the main emphasis is on the path. Once that theoretical context is clear, everything else is about the practice. This is the first thing that is interesting about these teachings of the Buddha. Very practical. It's not a description of reality just for the sake of describing reality. That is called philosophy. The Buddha is not really into philosophy. Philosophy is what happens later on in Buddhism, with the, I said it very much before, with the arising of the Abhidharma and all of this. That is when philosophy starts to become part of Buddhism. But it's a path, but it's a mental path. So I think the correct way of defining Buddhism, certainly early Buddhism, the Dhamma from the Buddha, if we need to define it at all, is a psychology. It's a way of changing our mental composition almost, so it becomes more pure, more wholesome, more conducive to happiness, less conducive to suffering, all of this. It's really a kind of psychology, how to deal with the mind, how to work with the mind, how to make the mind a better home for each one of us. What is also interesting about this is that the Buddha says he has discovered this. So exactly how has he discovered these 37 factors? What does it mean to discover these things? Because this is a path. How do you discover a path? The Kenma perhaps discovered a truth because, you know, the Buddha says the discovery of all noble truths, and you know, sometimes you have a discovery as a moment of insight into reality, you see something clearly there. And that, of course, is very much part of the Buddhist idea of insight into non-self, for example. When you contemplate your maya fully and body fully, you realize that nothing permanent there. And this is one type of insight, which is kind of a direct seeing. But the path is not so obvious why you would have insight into a path, because a path is something that stretches over a long period of time. So the way you have insight into a path, I think, is that first of all, you know the end result, where you want to get. Because you know the end result, you already have some idea of and what is required to get there, because the result will often give you some understanding of the means. And if the result is high degree of purity, high degree of effort as well, quite likely it is a path that leads towards happiness and purity that will get you there. Yeah? So the end result will give you some idea. The more important thing is that the Buddha had obviously spent his whole life practicing these 37 things. That's why he became awakened. These are, after all, the 37 aims of the awakening. So this is exactly what the Buddha would have practiced. So just by reflecting on his own practice, on his own life, he would have understood what the path is. They would have become completely different. So through that combination of understanding the final goal and looking back at his own experience, he would have been able to see what was going on, what was required. And that is, it was a discovery of a path, not just a, you know, something he made up. He had actually made it up to some extent, because he had to verbalize these things. You know, these things are pre-verbal. These are direct experiences, so you have to verbalize it. So in one sense, you can say it is made up. Yeah, but it was made up based on experience. And this is one of the reasons why it is so interesting to read some of the autobiographical sutras of the Buddha, where the Buddha talks about his own life. Yeah? He talks about his own practice, and it's precisely because he's showing us the path that led to that result for him. And it's there's actually quite a lot of sutras that are autobiographical in that sense. And they are very often very inspiring. Yeah? And the Buddha, instead of just kind of giving us a theoretical framework, he talks about his own life, how he struggled on the path, how he was able to find that middle way, actually. Sometimes going wrong, yeah, it's interesting. The Buddha to me, sometimes he goes wrong. Then he kind of finds the right track again, he gets back on the middle path, whatever it is. The Buddha is often mindful of that, so he's been tumbling around in the dark a little bit. Just like we all, most people are kind of tumbling around in the dark, yeah? We're trying to find our way through this, even though we have the teachings. So the Buddha was even more in darkness in many ways. So in this way, we can find a lot of inspiration in those ancient, autobiographical sutras of the Buddha. They're some of my favorite sutras, and sometimes I give the retreat just based on those sutras, because they're so inspiring and so full of insight into the path of practice and all of that. So these are the 37 aids to the awakening, and as I said before, they are mainly practical, but they are not just practical. How are they not just practical? And the way they are not just practical is that, for example, in the non-mental path, it starts with right view. And right view is the idea that Buddha lays down the Four Noble Truths, that this is the nature of reality. Especially when he says, you may not be aware of it, you may not be able to see it. One day, hopefully, you will be able to see it yourself, but this is the nature of where things are. And because you can't see it, I don't have to tell you, this is the way it is. This is where your faith and confidence in these teachings come in. Things like rebirth, for example, that is kind of fundamental part of it. And not just, so that is my view, that my view has the idea of rebirth and karma and a few other things. But of course, dependent origination is also part of that. Because dependent origination is really just an expansion of the second and third noble truths. The second noble truth is the arising of suffering, and suffering arises from craving. And dependent origination is just an expansion of that. And it shows you how craving always leads to suffering. Dependent origination point them out in minute detail. So it's about a little delusion and going through 12 steps, all taking you all the way to suffering. But it's basically the same thing. Which is interesting, isn't it? The second level truth is basically just another way of looking at dependent origination. Craving leads to suffering. Craving is the cause of suffering. I'm not going to talk too much about that because that would be a bit sidetracked here. Then you have the third noble truth, which is a similar kind of thing. It is that the ending of craving is the ending of suffering. And that is a contraction or a short version of what is called dependent cessation. Dependent cessation is when you instead of dependent origination, where all these links originate one after the other, but dependent cessation when the first link ceases in the 12-fold formula for dependent origination, the whole originates, but the whole rest of the formula also ceases, all those links. So dependent origination is marked then also in this framework, as on the five khandhas, because the five khandhas are part of the first noble truth of suffering, and the five khandhas is like the definition of suffering, if you want. The six sense bases are there, because that is also the definition of suffering in the sutras. So it all comes in there, even though this is a practical teaching, because the practical teaching needs that theoretical framework for it to have any meaning. Path only has meaning insofar as it actually is part of something larger, a particular worldview or whatever. So this is the first thing about these things, that what I would like to do is just to look at these 37 in a bit more detail,
because they really they deserve a little bit of detailed look, simply because they are the core of the teaching of the Buddha. Now, the one of the first things that you may not see straight away, but these 37, they actually reduce down to the Noble Eightfold Path. Which is kind of handy, because if you have to remember 37, well, you may have a problem, but if you can remember just the Noble Eightfold Path, it's easier. And then the good news is that the Noble Eightfold Path, for some people, even that's too long. So it not reduces down, it reduces down to a threefold training, which is the training in morality, training in samadhi or meditation, and the training in wisdom. Morality, meditation, and wisdom. That's what it reduces down to. And pretty much everybody can remember that, except in daily life when you're running around doing things, of course, but so sort of generally speaking. So you can see how these teachings, they kind of, they can expand them and contract them depending on the situation, depending on use, depending on requirement. And this is one of those nice things that I think Ajahn Siddhartha a long time ago, he said that the suttas are fractal. The idea of fractal geometry, fractal geometry, when you take you have a particular pattern, a pattern which starts there and ends here. Now, if you focus in on a small part of that pattern, it repeats the overall pattern in the big one. And you focus in on a smaller part of that other pattern, it repeats again, the same thing again and again. So regardless of the scale at which you look at this pattern, it is always looks the same. And the suttas are a bit like that. You can look at it large scale, small scale, different ways, and it's the same pattern that you see again and again. So just to show you, first of all, how that is, of course, the four applications of mindfulness, that is the same as sammasati in the Noble Eightfold Path. Sammasati is... by definition, it is the four satipatthanas, which are the four applications of mindfulness. Then you have the four right efforts. Four right efforts are the same. Is the same as the sixth factor, the right effort in the Noble Eightfold Path. Then you have the four idipadas, the four. Aspects of spiritual power, if you like, and these have very much to do with samadhi. There are different approaches to how to gain samadhi on the path, so they are very similar to the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is samadhi. So they fit in with that. So you can see how all of these things start to fit in together. Then you have the five spiritual faculties. Now, what about them? And the five spiritual faculties, they are just really an alternative way of looking at the Noble Eightfold Path. The Noble Eightfold Path is a general path that is available to everyone, whether you are an Arya, whether you are a noble person or not. So it is a general path that is applicable across the board. But the five spiritual faculties, usually they are said to be these are the faculties that the Aryas, the noble people have. So once you become a stream enter, a Sotapanna, or maybe slightly before that, only then do you acquire these five spiritual faculties. Just before you are a Sotapanna, you become a Dhammanusari or Saddhanusari, as a Dhamma follower or a faith follower. And these are like the stages immediately prior to stream entry, where you are guaranteed to become a stream enter later on in your life. That's where these faculties are established in you. And the reason why they are established in you at that stage is because you have insight. This is what it means to become a stream mentor. It means that you have insight into the Four Noble Truths. You know what the Buddha was talking about. And because you have that insight, it means that all the other factors become stable. They become stable because now you know what the practice is. You know what you have to give up. Because you have seen the emptiness of all the phenomena, it is easy for you to let go. You don't have any problem letting go anymore because you know there's nothing there to hold on to. So the path becomes automatic and you have these five spiritual faculties. Yeah, they are like embedded in you at this particular point. And because they are embedded in you, you don't need morality anymore. Morality is automatic. You know what the path is. Morality becomes part of who you are. It becomes part of your psychology in a sense. So that is why the factors of morality are not found in the five spiritual faculties. The five spiritual faculties are faith or confidence, virya, energy, sati, mindfulness, samadhi, stillness or concentration or stillness ideally, and then panya, which is wisdom. These are the five. You see, there's no morality there. There's no reason for morality because you've already gone beyond that. And when you look at it like that, you see it is very similar in many ways to the Noble Eightfold Path. You have wisdom and confidence instead of right view, but these things are very closely related to each other, and apart from that, it's basically the same. Then we have the five spiritual faculties that Peter asked about just a couple of minutes ago, and I finally got to them. So these are the Panchabala. What are they? And that is a very good question, because the answer is that the way they are explained in the sutta, they are explained as being the same as the five spiritual faculties. There's no difference according to the sutta as it seems, which is kind of weird. Yeah, you wonder why do you have two categories of five when they supposedly are just exactly the same? What is going on there? And it might be that they are just different names for the same thing. Yeah, it could be that, it could be the idea of powers of balas. That word is used slightly different in the suttas, and there are different groups of balas of powers, and it may be that the five powers here are extracted from one particular group of powers, whereas the faculties, which are often conjoined with other faculties, but different ones from the balas, may have been extracted from those other faculties. Something like that. In other words, they come from different eras of the Dhamma, but then when they are extracted, the essence of them are extracted out, they kind of are pretty much the same. So, or maybe there was originally a difference, but that has been lost, maybe in the mist of time, who knows? But now, it is actually a sutta which says they are the same. Specifically says these are the same. So, you know, you wonder why they are there. So maybe we should reduce the 37 down to 32, huh? You think so, huh? Yeah? That would be, maybe we should write a commentary on that. That's how the commentaries arise. People start to think, wait a minute, what's going on here? Why are these occur twice? And then you start thinking, and you spend your rest of your life writing a commentary on the Dhamma, and then you die. This is what happens, yeah? And then because you've gotten into the habit of writing commentaries, you get reborn in your next life, and because you are in the habit of being a monk, you're ordained, and because you're in the habit of writing commentaries, you find something else to write about in your next life. And this is the way to stay in samsara for a long, long time. This is probably what happens, yeah? This is kind of, I'm just saying, because This is such an important part of the Dhamma, the idea that we tend to follow our habits from one life to the next one. And it's kind of scary, because the things that trap us in this life tend to be the same thing that trap you in the future life as well. If you were able to look into your past life, you'd probably be horrified to see that you were trapped by pretty much the same thing in the past life as you are trapped by now. Yeah, it's kind of scary, because you start to feel like this robot that's just kind of can't really escape from the program that's written into you, and you're just kind of going around like a zombie, yes, or whatever, saying yes sir to whatever the program is saying, and that's what you're doing. And it's kind of it's a little bit worrying, isn't it? And sometimes a little bit of kind of worry about these things is probably a good thing, because it shows you that there's something to be done, there's something that needs to be sorted out in this life, otherwise we just keep on repeating the same problems again and 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 etc. etc. and millions of times. Yes, sir. Please. Yeah. 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 There is a sutta. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's right, because there is actually a sutta that says that. It says it doesn't. I don't think it says quite literally that they are the same. It says something that there is a way of looking at them that is the same. So because of that, I am. And if also you look at the definitions of it, the way they are defined in the suttas, they are defined pretty much in the same way here. So you have the saddha, sadindriya, defined as a full confidence in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Saddha bala, power of faith, is explained in exactly the same way here. So they are actually defined in the same way in the suttas as well. But the problem is that these definitions may be slightly later than the earliest usage of these things. They may have had a slight difference early on, and then as time went by, they kind of people weren't able to keep them apart anymore, and so they kind of became the same thing here. There is no evidence that it is like that at all, actually. Yeah, that's kind of the strange thing. There is no evidence of that. Maybe they were used simply as the indriya being a faculty in a sense of being an ability. Yeah? It is an ability that you have. It's an ability that you have an ability. You have faith. You have samadhi. You have all of these things. There's an ability inside of you. That's what faculty really means, an ability or capability. Whereas bala is a power. It may be more like something that empowers the path in a sense. It's a power to bring you forward towards awakening. Yeah? So maybe they have a slightly different. It is hardwired. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. 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 Oh. Okay. Yes, and so that is how they reduce down to the Noble Eightfold Path, a very similar Noble Eightfold. Then we have the seven factors of awakening, and the seven factors of awakening, the first one is the Sati Sambojanga, and the last one, or the sixth one of those, is the Samadhi Sambojanga. And then the factors in between, they are how you go from sati to samadhi, how you go from mindfulness to stillness. Yeah, it shows you that sequence, how you move from one to the other one. So the seven factors of awakening, they are an expansion of the last two factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So they kind of slot right in there. Yeah. So if you expand out the Noble Eightfold Path, you look at it in detail, this is what you get. You get the 37 factors, the 37 aids to awakening here. So this is how it reduces down to the Noble Eightfold Path, and how it expands out again to the 37 factors. So I want to go over this one more time, because there's a little bit more to be said about this. So first of all, the four satipatthanas, the right mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness, called the four applications of mindfulness. This is, of course, found in the Satipatthana Sutta. Yeah, so it is largely equivalent to the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, but not exactly equivalent. And this is one of the reasons why it is interesting to read these things. Because it is also, what is interesting about the Satipatthanas, when you practice them fully, they take you all the way to awakening. Yeah, this is what the Buddha promises in the Satipatthana Sutta. And one of the things to realize about that is that in the Satipatthana Sutta itself, it says that part of those factors that you contemplate or that you you investigate through Satipatthana or you practice are actually things that relate to samadhi. They relate to jhana practice. So for example, in the Satipatthana Sutta, it talks about things like the contemplation of Niramisa Sukha, the happiness, the unworldly happiness. Or it talks about the Mahagata Chitta. Mahagata means the mind that is great or large, or Apamana Chitta, the measureless mind. And all of these things are terms that apply to samadhi and jhanas. So within Satipatthana, if you want to look at Satipatthana in all its breadth and scope, it actually includes the jhanas as well. Normally it doesn't. Normally Satipatthana is what leads you to the jhanas, but in its full ramifications, if you want to look at it in its broadest possible scope, it also includes the jhanas. And this is why the Satipatthana Sutta is not actually a blueprint for insight, pure insight without the jhanas, because actually the jhanas are right there embedded in the Satipatthana Sutta itself. So you have to read these things with great care to get these finer details of what is going on. So the four factors of mindfulness, in a sense, what they are about, the last element of purification of the mind, and then leading the mind all the way to the jhanas. That is what it is about. They are gradual, yeah? So you have the kaya nupassana, the contemplation of the body. The kaya nupassana is usually explained as the 31 parts of the body. And the idea is just to make you a little bit less interested in the body. Give a sense of detachment, less attachment to the body. That is what that first one is about. Go into the contemplation of feelings, which can be done purely through mindfulness of breathing. Then you have the contemplation of mind, and then you have the contemplation of dhammas, which is the last one. And contemplation of dhammas is defined as the contemplation of the five hindrances and the seven bhujangas. The contemplation of the seven bhujangas is part of the Satipatthana Sutta, understanding what they are. And that is all about samadhi practice again. We'll see in a second. So you can see how integrated all of this is. It all comes together in a sense. It is all really one thing, but it's pulled apart and shown in different angles, different viewpoints. But it all really belongs together in one big picture. That's why sometimes I like to look at the Dhamma as a jigsaw puzzle, and all these pieces fitting together, and like a jigsaw, and making one big picture. Sometimes all you see is a tiny little piece, but gradually you start to see what this is all about. So that is the four Satipatthanas in brief. It is one of those very comprehensive or large subjects that really need to be taught comprehensively, and I have done so here before over three different sessions, I think, just for the Satipatthana Sutta. So it's a large topic. Then we have the four right efforts. And this is another very important set. One of the things that you see here is that the four Satipatthanas, the four mindfulness meditations, the four right efforts, and the four samadhis, the four ways to spiritual power. This is basically effort, it is mindfulness, and it's samadhi. That's what these three things are. So they are equivalent to the last three factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So they stand out. Because there's four of each one of these. And then if you look at the other factors we just have been looking at before, the five spiritual faculties of the Noble Eightfold Path, and you take out the samadhi and sati and effort from those as well, all of those too include those factors. So there is at least eight times are these things mentioned in here.
8 times, and that's 3 of them, 8 times 3 is 24. So out of the 37 Bodhipakyadhammas, 24 are about effort, mindfulness, and samadhi. So these are by far the most important ones. This is what almost defines the Buddhist path. Yeah? The other things here kind of pale in significance compared to that. This is a very important point already, because it shows you what a large part what Buddhism is about. What is that about? What is right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi about? And what it really is about, it is about the mental cultivation, the cultivation of the mind. That is what it is about. How to move the mind from a state it is in now or in the past or whatever, and move it towards a state whereby you're able to have real insight. This is what the whole purpose of this path is about. And it shows so clearly in this 37 Bodhipakyadhammas, because these three factors is what you see there more than anything else. The other factors, like, for example, virtue that you have in the Noble Eightfold Path, well, it's more common. It's not so special in Buddhism, and it's fairly easy to understand what it is about. Wisdom, faith, and right view. These are, of course, right view, of course, is very important as a framework, and wisdom and faith are related to that. So that is like almost 5 times. That is also a very important part of this, but still not as important as the actual method or the ways for purifying your mind. So this is what really comes stands out here as the most important of these 37 factors. So the four right efforts then, the four right efforts, again, they can be looked upon narrowly as the four right efforts that you use to enable a mindfulness meditation. Yeah, you put in the effort to purify yourself mentally, especially to overcome things like anger and strong desires and these kind of things. And then you are able to, you know, to mindfulness meditation becomes possible on that basis. But there's also a broader way of looking at the four right efforts. They are also, in one way, they also constitute almost the path all the way to the end. They include such things as a guarding the meditation object. So if you have a meditation object firmly in mind, guarding that, in that sense it is very close to sati, yeah, to the seventh factor. But they also include the development of the bhujangas, the awakening factors. Again, so it's very close to samadhi. So again, when it's expanded out, it includes all the last three factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Effort, mindfulness, and samadhi is included in this. I'm just trying to kind of show you the scope of these things, so you kind of get some idea of what these things are about. Then we have the four roads to power. It says Iddhipada, the four factors of spiritual power. In other words, the four powers that give rise to awakening, etc. These are different ways or different kind of, depending on where we start out, we apply ourselves slightly differently. So for most people, you have to have a certain interest or chanda when you start out. So the first of these four Iddhipadas is called chanda samadhi. It is the samadhi or the stillness of mind that you gain from chanda. You apply yourself based on your, not a strong desire, but a degree of desire to actually get there. When we start out on the path, we have to want to do it. We have to want to sit down. If you don't want to do it, it's not going to happen. Yeah? So there has to be some desire there, otherwise it's hopeless. That's not going to work at all. So for the most basic type of meditation, at least you have to come to the Buddha Society to the Friday night that needs some sort of desire to get you here. Otherwise you wouldn't be here. It needs some sort of desire to make you sit down. It takes a little bit of desire initially to get the mind in the right direction, and then you abandon that desire as you go deeper. That is a bit like right effort again. Yeah. Then we have the virya samadhi. This is a samadhi based on virya, on the energy of the mind. And if you have quite a pure mind already, and you have that energy in the mind which comes with the purity of mind, then you sit down and you just apply that energy to your meditation topic. And as you do so, the samadhi arises. Then you have the citta samadhi. The citta samadhi is citta is the mind. It's really just another way of talking about samadhi. So that is, if you already are quite still, you can just kind of carry on. And the last one is the vimansa samadhi, where you use your insight, your understanding of the Dhamma to enable you. Because when you have deep insight, you know what you have to do. You know what you have to let go of. So you just remind yourself. You remember the Dhamma, and then you let go, and you go bang straight into samadhi straight away. Yeah, isn't that that sounds good, doesn't it? Yeah. And some people can do that. I know some people who can do this kind of things. When you are a monk, you are privy to some things that is not so easy for lay people to get access to. I shouldn't say that. That makes you jealous. But it's true, right? There are people in this world who have incredible abilities in samadhi practice. And when they are ready, sometimes they just sit down and the nimitta comes up and bang, they go into a deep state of samadhi just like that. Yeah, it would be nice, wouldn't it? So this is, and that is really what Vimamsa Samadhi and Citta Samadhi are about, this really fast-tracked way into Samadhi, because all the preliminary things have been put into place. So now you can see why the Idipadas, they cover also a fairly wide range. Everything starting really from right effort, yeah, to right Samadhi. So you can see how these three things are so crucial. Effort, mindfulness and samadhi. Everything kind of revolves around these three things. Everything really, that's where everything comes down to. Yeah, effort or energy, mindfulness and then samadhi. Sometimes it's called energy because effort doesn't necessarily mean that you actually apply yourself. It can just mean the natural energy of the mind. Yeah, so you just go with the natural energy of the mind. If you read the what's it called? The Mahachatparisaka Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 117, it says precisely this, that these three factors tend to revolve around these three factors. Then we come to the five spiritual faculties, and as I mentioned before, this is just a contraction of the Noble Eightfold Path. And it is a contraction that is used for Aryas. And it starts off with right, okay. I think my computer is about to conk out. Doesn't have any more batteries, so I'm going to move over to the old-fashioned way of doing this. This is the old-fashioned way. The good thing about the computer is that you can have the Pali there, the English there, and you can have alternative translations over here. Yeah, you can have everything in one place, but this is a bit more limited. Anyway, we'll use what we can have. So the five spiritual faculties is what the noble ones have, and it starts off with sadda, which is faith, the sad indriya, and sad indriya is an interesting thing, this idea of faith in Buddhism. And it comes out very clearly here in these five faculties. Because it is slightly misleading to translate sadda as faith. Because usually in a religious context, when we talk about faith, we talk about something that precisely we do not know. Yeah, it's about something that you have faith in. It precisely means you don't know it. It means you put your faith in these things. But here, we are talking about the faith of the noble ones, and that is a faith that arises precisely through knowledge, precisely through insight. That is why faith is the first of the spiritual faculties. Yeah, you have the full faith, full confidence in the Buddha, because you know that what he has said is true. So it's a different conception, different idea of faith. But it has something else in common with faith. And it has in common with faith the idea that there's also an emotional aspect to faith. Yeah, faith is often emotional, you know, and exactly the same thing is true in Buddhism. When you understand these teachings fully, you tend to feel inspired. You tend to feel joyful because you know what these things are. And in that sense, it is similar to faith and perhaps less similar to confidence. So it's a bit of a toss-up whether one should translate it as faith or confidence, but it's important to understand the limitations of these things. When we talk about faith here, we talk about the confirmed faith of the noble ones, confirmed through insight. And the last factor of the five spiritual faculties is precisely the Panya Indriya, the faculty of wisdom. Yeah, and that is what stabilizes the other faculties. Because you have that insight, the wisdom, the other five faculties are always there. So it's easy. When you're Aryan, it's really easy. All you have to do is remember the teaching of the Buddha, Yeah, and you know it because you know it already in your heart. All you have to do is kind of go back to some of those insights you had before, and then bang, straight away you kind of back, you're back in the groove again, and you're practicing in the right way. The noble ones, they can lose their way for a short period of time because they get kind of overwhelmed by too much business, that kind of thing. But once they go on retreat, things tend to come back very, very fast again for noble ones. So that is the and because all of these other faculties are stabilized by the panya, by the wisdom, it means that energy, mindfulness and samadhi, they're always kind of closely at hand for the noble ones. And this is one of the ways that you can know whether someone is a noble person or not. How much access do they have to samadhi? How easy is it for them to attain samadhi? If somebody has a hard time attaining samadhi, they're not going to be Aryans, because it comes with the territory. When you have that insight, that insight means you're able to let go. That's the whole point of the insight. You know where the suffering is, so you can let go. Because you can let go, samadhi happens very, very quickly and very easily. That's kind of the point of this. Okay. That's the the five spiritual faculties, the five powers, basically the same. And that's my view of this. If you can find someone who can give you a different explanation, then I'd be very keen on hearing that. I went to the nuns' monastery a few weeks ago and gave them a teaching. One of the nuns wanted to argue with me that there was a difference between these two. We didn't really come to a proper conclusion. But maybe there is something, if you look really carefully, you might be able to find some difference. So please let me know if you find something interesting about that. Then we have the seven factors of awakening. And this is a very interesting set of qualities. And these are the factors, they're called the seven factors of awakening because they lead to awakening. So if you want to become awakened, this is what you have to do. And these, as I said, what they are a summary of the last two factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So the first one of these seven factors is the Sati Sambhujanga. Sati is mindfulness, yeah? Sambhujanga is a factor of awakening. Sambodhi is awakening itself. So this is a sati factor, the mindfulness factor of awakening. And the mindfulness factor of awakening is the same thing as the satipatthanas, as the mindfulness meditation. So these things are based on mindfulness meditation. What is mindfulness meditation? It is when you sit down, you watch your breath, you're doing mindfulness meditation. Yeah? That's all you have to do. Sit down, watch your breath, and you are on the highway, the high road to awakening as a consequence. Yeah? You feel like you're on the high road to awakening when you watch your breath? Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you feel, oh, the breath, you don't have any energy. But other times, when the energy arises, yeah, and you feel so happy with your breath, you feel, yeah, maybe this is the highway or high road to awakening. Yeah. You know what I mean? It varies a lot. It depends on the circumstances. But this is really what it is. This is the first part of the Sambhujangas. Mindfulness of breathing, or some other aspect of satipatthana, but mindfulness of breathing is really the main way that satipatthanas are practiced. From that comes the Dhammavicaya Sambhujanga. Dhammavicaya means investigation of dhammas, investigation of qualities. So this is the awakening factor that is investigation of qualities. What are these qualities that we are supposed to investigate? And what they are the good and the bad qualities of mind. Yeah, the suttas say elsewhere, the dark and the bright qualities of mind, the blameworthy and blameless qualities of mind, the wholesome and unwholesome qualities of mind. And this is exactly the same thing that you see in the Satipatthana Sutta again, in the Mindfulness Meditation Sutta. At the very end of that sutta, it talks about the five hindrances, how to overcome them. It talks about the seven Sambhujangas, which is exactly this, how to give rise to them. Yeah, it's about how to differentiate, investigate the bad qualities and the good qualities, and by doing that, understanding them and then overcoming them as a consequence. Yeah, you see what I'm talking about? So it is very similar to the Satipatthana practice. The first two factors of the factors of awakening are basically equivalent to the four Satipatthanas. The four Satipatthanas themselves are sequential. Everything in Buddhism is sequential. Everything has a beginning and an end. So you start off with body contemplation. You end up with a contemplation of dhammas or principles, the five hindrances, the seven factors of awakening. And here you see the same thing in short form within the Sambuddhangas. Am I making sense to anyone? Yeah? You sure? Okay. Good. I'm sometimes a bit concerned that I'm kind of... So please ask. If you think that you have no idea what I'm talking about and you want to kind of stop me in my tracks and sort of say, what is going on, then please do so. Because, I realize one of the problems with these Dhamma classes is that people who come here come from all kinds of levels of understanding. Some of you know more Dhamma than I do. But or at least as much, perhaps. But some of you are beginners. Yeah. So there's a kind of a broad difference in levels, and that kind of makes it difficult to find a nice balance. But the point is, if you gain something out of these things, then it's a good start. And the rest of it, kind of, you internalize it, you let it be there, and as time goes on, these things start to bear fruit, and you start to understand what is going on. But again, please ask whenever there, if you have any doubts about anything here. So that is the second factor of awakening, the Dhammavicaya Sambuddhanga, the investigation of qualities factor of awakening here. From that comes the Virya Sambuddhanga. Virya is energy, and the factor of awakening, that is energy. And that arises because when you let go of all those bad qualities after investigating them, you get the natural joy and energy in the mind. The energy comes up, you feel energized inside, your mind is full of energy. It's easy to do meditation, it's easy to do all these kind of things because the energy is there. And then from that energy comes the piti, which is the joy, inner joy. Energy and joy are very closely connected to each other. There's a natural joy that comes with the energy very often. You can often feel very powerful joy at this particular stage. One thing building on the next one, one after the other. Then comes the tranquility Sambuddhanga, pasaddhi Sambuddhanga, which is the, pasaddhi is like calm, translated as tranquility very often. And this is the mind, the factor of awakening, which is tranquility. Then you become incredibly tranquil. You're sitting there like you don't want to do anything else in the whole world. Absolutely still. Your mind is still, your body is still. And it becomes, at this point, meditation becomes incredibly beautiful. What you are seeing here, by the way, is all the process of meditation. Yeah, this is a process of meditation that you're seeing here. How it actually works out. In the Noble Eightfold Path, all it says is mindfulness, then samadhi, stillness. But here, it spreads it out and it shows you all the various stages that you normally go through. And then from that pasaddhi Sambuddhanga comes the samadhi Sambuddhanga, the stillness or the samadhi factor of awakening itself. So now you are finally reaching the jhanas, you're finally reaching these very higher stages. And then if you want to keep on practicing the jhanas, eventually you get to the upekkha Sambuddhanga. Upekkha is like equanimity or balance of mind perhaps. And this is what happens when you get to the very highest jhanas, the third and the fourth jhana, you get this equanimity. Yeah, you've taken the jhana practice to its very highest level. And that is where these factors of awakening end. You have now practiced the path to awakening fully. And as a consequence of practicing this path fully, guess what happens? You become awakened. Yeah, you're awakened. All you have to do is really this. If you have done this in the right way, it is based on right view at the beginning, this is what you have to do. And then awakening happens as a consequence. This is what it's all about. And one of the things that is interesting about this is that the seven factors of awakening, they are very closely related to another set in the suttas that I often talk about called dependent liberation. And that dependent liberation is also a sequence of turns, one thing leading to the next one, ending in liberation. And it's very closely related to this. And what that sequence says, it starts off with sila, with morality. From morality comes non-regret. From non-regret comes pamuja, gladness. From gladness comes piti. Yeah, we just saw piti as one of the factors here before. If you look at these factors and you compare, they're very closely, it may not be obvious when I'm saying it now, but they're actually very closely related to each other. From the piti comes pasaddhi, tranquility, which is another factor that you saw in here. From pasaddhi comes sukha, which is not mentioned here, but it's it's just another intermediate term. From sukha comes samadhi, which is one of the sambhujangas, one of the factors of awakening. Yeah? From samadhi comes yathabhuta jnanadarsana, seeing things according to reality. Yeah? From seeing things according to reality comes nibbida, which is like the repulsion from suffering. Yeah? Repulsion from almost everything in the world that is suffering, which is pretty much everything. Yeah? Then, having been repelled by that suffering, then you have viraga, the letting go of all of that. And because you let go of all of that, you are released. Vimutti is the last factor. So those two sequences are very, very closely related to each other. And what that shows you, it shows you the importance of the sequence we call dependent liberation, because it is also found in the seven factors of awakening. So that sequence is actually very fundamental to the suttas. It shows you one of the basic principles of how meditation works. And of course, once you start to read that sequence of principles of how meditation works, it is marvelous. It is absolutely astonishing. And what is so astonishing about it, even here in the Bhujangas, it is that it's all about happiness. Yeah, gladness, rapture, happiness, tranquility. Samadhi, of course, is all about happiness. Seeing things according to reality is happiness. That is all it is about. So meditation practice, when it works according to the way it is described in the suttas, the way you should experience it is just one level of happiness after the other. And this is so inspiring. It is so uplifting. It's hard to hard to overemphasize how important this is, because this is one of the things that gives you real desire, if you like, to practice this path. Yeah, that gets you going, because the promise of happiness is just so fundamental to the entire Buddhist outlook and the Buddhist path and the Buddhist way of practice. So please keep that in mind. And sometimes in Buddhism, I think we do too much hard practices that are tough and too much pain-focused, and I think often it holds us back, because if something is painful, it is very much more difficult to have a desire for practicing that which is painful than it is to have a desire to practice that which is naturally happy. And the Buddhist path should be a happy one. Of course, nothing is happy all the time, it doesn't work like that, but a general trend should be happiness. So that is how the seven factors of awakening fit into the Noble Eightfold Path and the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas. And the last one is the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, the Noble Eightfold Path being the usual one, right view, yeah, right outlook if you like, right purpose, right aim, the second one, right, that's where this is just my translation, so right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, mindfulness meditation, and right stillness at the end, right samadhi coming at the end there. So, there you are, 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas. You okay with those 37? They seem reasonable? They seem, yeah? Happy with those? Okay, good. Okay, so that is the Buddha's teachings, and this is what he laid down, and this is what he tells the monks should remember. These are the things you should remember, and as you remember these things, this is what will keep Buddhism going in the world for a long, long time into the future. Even 2,500 years later, in Perth, in a faraway continent called Australia, even then it will happen. Which is kind of cool, because we are that future right now. So what the Buddha is talking about here, basically we are almost like the result of that. The fact that they did remember those things. And if we want to help other people to gain the same benefits in the future, then we should do the same thing in this life. And practicing these things is really the critical issue. So, let us move on. I spent much longer on that than I had expected, to be honest. I thought it was going to take about 10 minutes, but this is usually how things tend to go. So, now, the Buddha has just told the monks, and the nuns, and probably the lay people as well, how to live in the future, and now he kind of gives them some more advice. Yeah, at the very end, he knows that his parinibbana is not far away, and now he's starting to give them this final advice. Then the Lord said to the monks, and now monks, I declare to you, all conditioned things are of a nature to decay. Strive on untiringly. The Tathagata's final passing will not be long delayed. 3 months from now, the Tathagata will take his final Nibbana. And that particular message there is one of the very famous messages. It is a message that you find also just before the Buddha is about to pass away. Yeah? Just before he's about to pass away, when he's literally on his deathbed, this is exactly what he says. Vaya Dhamma Sankara Appamadena Sampadeta is that famous one there. All conditioned things are of a nature to decay. Strive on untiringly. Vaya Dhamma Sankara. Vaya Dhamma Sankara, Vaya means decay or ending or stopping or destruction or something like that. Sankara is a conditioned phenomena, or basically all phenomena on the world are conditioned. Yeah, so basically means everything. Everything is of a nature to end, to decay, to be destroyed, to disappear. This is the first thing he says. Yeah, remember, these are the last days of the Buddha, right? This is the very end of his kind of his teaching career. The things that he is saying now must be things that, in a sense, summarize his entire teaching. Yeah, this is kind of the summary of what he has been teaching for so long. This is the essence of right view, if you like. This is the basis for the entire practice. Vaya Dhamma Sankara. If you remember that much, basically you're already, you know, doing really well, because so much in our life, we actually, is a problem that we forget that things are always subject to decay, is always subject to ending and stopping in this way. Vaya Dhamma Sankara. And as a basis, as that, with that view, right view as a basis, then appamadena sampadeta. Sampadeta means like succeed or practice or, you know, strive, if you like. Appamadena, with heedfulness or with diligence. Being heedful, being careful, being diligent in how you do things. Yeah, and that summarizes what we saw before, the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas. That is where you are heedful. But to the foundation for all of this, and this is where we come back again to the idea of the Buddhist outlook and the Buddhist worldview, that the practice has to have some kind of framework. This is the framework, the Vaya Dhamma Sankara. All conditioned phenomena are of a nature to decay and a nature to cease and to end. This is kind of that framework around that. And so, please remember that framework. What does it mean? And what it means, you know, some of the most important things to remember have the nature to cease. Some of the most important things is basically the world around us. Because if we always remember that the world around us, what is the world around us? The world around us is the world of the five senses. Yeah. So when we, in Buddhism, when we talk about being attached to sensual pleasures, not always obviously what that means, but what it means being attached to the world around us. That's really what it means. Because right now I look out, I see the beautiful sun and the gardens outside. I can easily be attached to that. Where I come from, we have nothing like that. It's very beautiful from my perspective. And that's why so many from, you know, from my country come here for holidays, because they see what I see now on TV or whatever, or in the tourist brochures, and they come to Perth and think, yeah, Perth sounds really cool, yeah, it's so blooming cold here in Norway, so let's go down to Perth and kind of heat up a little bit before we go back to the freezer back home. And so you attach to these things because there is a certain beauty in the world. Yeah, there's a certain beauty in the environment around us. But you also understand that beauty that we see in the world, whatever it is always unreliable. It is always uncertain. It will always change. In the end, it always, every time, it will let you down. This is the problem with the five senses. This is the problem with the world outside. It will always let you down. Sometimes you have to experience these things to be able to really get it. But it's good to reflect on these things, because as you do so, it gradually sinks down. Yeah, your relationships with anyone in this world is ultimately going to let you down. This is what's happening in the sutta, is that the monk's relationship with the Buddha is about to come to an end. It's letting them down. Yeah, Vaya Dhamma Sankara, the Buddha's telling them, what do you expect? This is supposed to happen. And so many things in the world, you know, if you ever feel kind of upset about what's happening in the world, well, that's where you have an attachment. Yeah, that's where you're not able to understand that via Dhamma Sankhara, things are always changing. Things are always out of control. Things are not going to go the way you want them. So if you're ever upset about politics or the environment or anything in the world, with the other people or your job or whatever it is, well, that's what you can expect to some extent. Yeah, so it doesn't mean that you just become fatalistic and just accept it. You can do a little bit about it, but you are not surprised when it happens. You don't grieve. You don't think anything has gone wrong. Actually, what happens when you do that, you start to get a bit of aversion to that whole world outside. You get a bit of, I've had enough of all that. Don't want to deal with that anymore because it's so much suffering. Anything that lets you down all the time is suffering by definition. Yeah, when people let us down, it's suffering. When the world lets us down, by definition, it's suffering. The world is always going to let us down, so it is always suffering. So implied in Vaidhamma Sankhara is the noble truth of suffering. It is right there. So remember that, and this is why we saw just before, that was I think last time a few times ago, when the Buddha talks about finding a refuge in the world, he says the right refuge is always in mindfulness meditation. Yeah, closing your eyes, going inside of yourself, that is where you find a refuge. Because if there's one thing we have some degree of control over, it is our inner life. The external world is almost completely out of our control, but our inner life we can do something about. We can develop it, we can purify it, we can make it a refuge, we can make it our real home, but not the external world. So we come back to this, and this is what this whole path is about, finding that refuge within. And it becomes very useful, it becomes incredibly valuable, because actually it enables you to deal with the world. It enables you to, when you have a refuge inside, it means the external world is no longer so important to you. You're able to deal with it. And gradually you make that shift. Yeah, gradually, it's a very gradual process. Until eventually you achieve full freedom. And that is when you have a full sense of autonomy inside of yourself. It even goes beyond that, because it even goes, even the internal phenomena are ultimately impermanent, so you even have to go beyond that. But the first thing to do is to learn about the external world and finding refuge within. This is the first thing. And then once you do that fully, within samadhi, within mindfulness meditation, then you take it further and find the full kind of liberation and insight beyond that. But that is already plenty for most people to get that far. And if you get to that point already, then you can just come, you know, you can listen to some of the other Sutta readings or go to Ajahn Brahm or whatever, and then take the next step after that. So this is Vaya Dhamma Sankhara, the Buddha summarizing his outlook of the world. Yeah, very important statement. These things are very useful to reflect on, because it takes a long time for these things to sink in. I know so many people sometimes saying, oh yeah, you know, this is such obvious thing that all things are impermanent. And in one way, it is kind of obvious, but in other way, it is not. We are still shocked by things being impermanent. We're still shocked by the world going the wrong way. And the reason why we are shocked is precisely because we haven't taken it properly on board yet. Once you take these things properly on board, nothing has the ability to shock you anymore. That's how you know that you have found that full insight into these things. So very, very powerful reflections. And then, as a consequence of that, you then apply yourself with heedfulness, with care, carefully, with circumspection. Yeah, and this is what comes from that right view as a natural outcome of it. So then the Buddha says he will pass away in 3 months. Yeah, so he's kind of set the limit on that, which is kind of nice, so everyone knows when he's going to pass away. Please ask your last questions now. Never delay. If you have a question to ask Ajahn Brahm, ask it now. If you see his diet, you know, you should ask it very quickly, because you don't know what's going to happen next. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's uncertain. Yeah? Even if he had a perfectly good diet, it still would be really uncertain. But if you add that diet to it, even more unreliable, even more uncertain. So, just saying. Buddha will pass away in 3 months, and then we have this little verse here. So I'll just read this little verse out. Thus the Lord spoke. The welfarer having spoken thus, the teacher said this. ripe I am in years, my lifespan is determined. What is the Pali? I've got the Pali here. This is not a very good translation. Paripakkam. I think it's my life has come to an end or something here. Now I go, having made myself a refuge. And this is the ultimate refuge, yeah, the Buddha has made for himself, the Arahant, he has let go of everything in the world. That's the kind of the ultimate refuge, and there are no more problems. Monks, be untiring, mindful, and disciplined, guarding your mind with well-collected or with stilled intentions, is another translation, with intentions stilled. He who tirelessly keeps the Dhamma and the discipline, or practices the Dhamma and the Vinaya, leaving birth behind, will put an end to woe, to suffering, in other words. I wish I had the Pali here, because, let's see if I can revive this a little bit here. So he says there towards the end there, he says, monks, be untiring, mindful, and disciplined. That really it says, monks, be heedful, mindful, and this is strength. And susila means having good morals. That's what it means. It doesn't really mean discipline. Having good morals. Su samahita sankapa means having well stilled intentions. Yeah, guarding your mind. Sachittang anurakata means guarding your own mind. Your immasmin dhamma vinaya. Whoever in this dhamma, in this spin, in other words, in the teaching of the Buddha, lives appamatto, lives heedful. Yeah, who, in other words, you are heedful in this dhamma and discipline. Having given up jati sangsara, having given up the round of rebirth, so similar to what here, he will make an end, or they will make an end to suffering here. Dukkas antang karisati here. That is just, and again, one of those little exhortations from the Buddha, exhortations from the Buddha, where he just tells the monks, kind of, sometimes he uses little verses like that just to kind of add a little bit and to make it a bit more emotional, perhaps, because verses often goes more to the heart, and this is what he's doing here. And what is nice about this, he's kind of a promise that if you are heedful, he says tireless here, but heedful is better. If you are tireless in this teaching and practice, Dhamma Vinaya, then you will leave rebirth behind. Then you will leave suffering behind. You will make an end of suffering. So it's almost a promise that this teaching works. If you do it fully and properly, then the results will happen as a consequence. And this is the great thing about this teaching. There's almost like a promise there that this will happen. And this is one of the reasons why it is sometimes nice to meet people who have practiced this path for a long time. People like Ajahn Brahm, who you can kind of see the benefits of the practice. People who are very stable, who are pretty much always happy and jolly, and who, who actually have gain some of these results. So actually, sometimes it can be useful just to meet people like that, because it gives you that sense that these things actually are possible. Just reading the suttas is often not enough. You have to sometimes see the living example. And this is one reason why, as long as there are Aryans in the world, people who actually understand this teaching through personal insight, then the Dhamma will keep on existing in the world, because it's possible to see with your own eyes that people are actually getting these results. Shall we go on a bit longer, or are you exhausted? Shall we go on a bit longer? Are you okay? I'll go on a bit longer. And if you are exhausted or you have to leave, please feel free to do so. So I know that some people have more energy than others. Okay. So now we come to the fourth part of this sutta. So I just finished the third part. It means we're halfway through. It's good news, isn't it? So I have good news for you. We're halfway through. So now it's kind of the home stretch. So now we can get it's actually going to be much faster from here on, because some of the material at the beginning is far more kind of comprehensive and involved than the later material. So it's much more. So it's going to be easier from here on. Okay. Then the Lord, having risen early and robed up, took his robe and bowl and went into Vaisali for alms. Having returned from alms round and eaten, he looked back at Vaisali with his elephant look and said to Ananda, "Ananda, this is the last time the Tathagata will look upon Vaisali. Now we will go to Bandagama." "Very good, Lord," said Ananda, and the Lord proceeded with a large company of monks to Bandagama and stayed there. So now the Buddha is proceeding, and from Vaisali he will eventually go to Pava. Pava is the place where he has his last meal, and then he proceeds from Pava to Kushinara, which is where he will eventually pass away. So this is his kind of very last leg of his voyage that we're coming to now. And the first place he's going to is this place called Bandagama. And just very briefly, just what is happening here, he is looking back at Vaisali with his elephant look, Naga Palokita. And this is one of these, almost like an epithet of the Buddha, that he looks at things with the elephant look. The elephant look, apparently when an elephant wants to look behind, an elephant turns the whole body around. Yeah? Human beings, we can kind of look over our shoulder, but elephants, because they are so big, they have to turn the whole body around. So it seems, according to this, the Buddha would turn all the way around to look behind. And this particular way of talking about the Buddha is only found in a couple of places in the suttas. Here and another sutta was very mythological. The Mahapadana Sutta, Digha Nikaya 14, is also said. So it looks to me as if this is just a way, again, of almost eulogizing the Buddha after he's passed away. Remember, this is a narrative, and this narrative would in large part have been composed after the Buddha passed away. And these are things that were probably added afterwards. So this would have been a very probably kind of noble way, considered noble way of doing things, that you don't just turn your head around, but if you look behind, you do it properly, you turn around. So it would have been a way of kind of elevating the Buddha again into something more than just an ordinary being. So the Naga Palokita, I think that's why it is mentioned here. It is mentioned just for this particular purpose of elevating the Buddha. And then he says, when he does that, he says, "This is the last time I will see Vaisali." Yeah, and it's kind of interesting, because I can imagine that this particular phrase, the way it is being expressed, would have very different effects on different people. The Buddha probably very happy to see Vaisali for the last time. Yeah, finally rid of that Vaisali, so noisy, so many people, so many vehicles, so much, so much rap music or techno going on, at night and that kind of stuff. Very noisy, and actually really nice to be able to get out of there, finished with all of that, and now move on to peace. So for the Buddha is more like, okay, get rid of one more piece of suffering in my life, getting rid of Vaisali. Is that what he's meaning by that? I don't know. I'm just kind of making it up, but that may be what he's meaning. Probably the Buddha is not all that interested in Vaisali, let's face it. But for the people who hear this, the Buddha saying this, it would have been perhaps a bit sad. Yeah, this is the last time. It kind of reminds them of the impermanence of the Buddha. It reminds them that he is on his way to passing away. This is coming very close to the end. He's seeing things for the last time. He's doing things. And as we go through the Mahapanibbana Sutta, there is more and more things that he does for the last time. He has his last meal. Yeah, he travels his last journey towards where he finally settles down between Pava and Kushinara, and he does many things like that for the last time. It's almost as if they're kind of counting down the time towards his ending. Yeah. And what is also interesting, what I noticed when I was reading this a few days ago, is how the as you get closer to the time of passing away, time is expanding. More and more details are being told about the Buddha's life as you get closer to the passing away. So on the very deathbed, it is explained in great, great detail. The last journey, getting to the deathbed, is explained in a little bit less detail. The last meal, in a little bit less detail again. And then the rest of the Mahapanibbana Sutta, in a less detail. It's more and more detail, as if people are trying to expand the time out, to make it as long as possible before the Buddha is passing away. Yeah, they want to keep the Buddha. They are afraid of his passing away. And they want to remember all these details. Because they are, this is the Buddha who's about to go away. They want to get as much out of him as possible to the very last minute. I think this is what this is about here towards the very end. And this is what we're starting to see right here. So the Buddha is looking at Vaisali and now moving on to Bandhagama. And when they arrive in Bandhagama, yes, please, sir. Yeah. 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 Indeed, Yeah. This is the last look at Vaisali, but yes. Yeah. Indeed, I absolutely agree with that. There's definitely a teaching there, and the teaching is again part of it is also, I think, the teaching of impermanence. Yeah, this is my last look. So again, he's driving home that point again one more time. And the last look actually is good. It's a positive thing. It is, as you say, it is a result of his achievement. It is a result of awakening. It's a positive thing, you know? And, exactly. Yeah, we should all aspire to the last look. Yeah. We usually want to have a first look at things, but we should rather have a last look at things. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, good. So, okay. And then they arrive at Bandhagama, and this is what happens there. And there the Lord addressed the monks. It is monks to not understanding, not penetrating four things that I, as well as you, have for a long time fared on round the cycle of rebirths. What are the four? To not understanding the Aryan morality, to not understanding the Aryan stillness or concentration, to not understanding the Aryan wisdom, to not understanding the Aryan liberation. I, as well as you, have for a long time fared on round the cycle of rebirths. And this again is one of those interesting things. I mentioned this here the other day, I can't remember, on Saturday or something. And it's one of those nice little things that the Buddha talks about in a number of places. When he talks about how we have fared on, sangsarati, sangdavati, which means literally kind of going round and round and round. And it is translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi as roaming. We have roamed and wandered on through sangsara. And it's a very nice and evocative idea, the idea of roaming. The word roaming in English means that you are aimless. Yeah, you roam around, means that you haven't got any aim. You're kind of just moving randomly around. And this is exactly what the point is with samsaric existence. It is aimless. Yeah, we're not actually going anywhere. This is true in the macro scale of going from life to life. We tend to start all over again in our next life, make the same mistakes. Sometimes we get a bit better, sometimes we get a bit worse. But essentially, it is doing the same things over again. We're not actually, there's no kind of end to it, there's no purpose to it, apart from the fact that you get reborn. And that is not a purpose in its own right. So you just go round and round and round doing the same thing. It has no point, it has no purpose, it has no aim in itself. And it's a very useful reflection because it turns you off the idea of samsaric existence a little bit. And also, it is also partly true in this life. Yeah, all the things that we aspire for in this life, that we try to achieve, we try to do, they don't actually give that satisfaction and fulfillment that we really want. When we come to the end of our lives, usually we still have desires, we still have aspirations, we still have things we want to move on to. It's not as if we are completely satisfied and we're happy, you know, we found the kind of final truth or anything like that. No, it's never really like that. In fact, it is that very desire, the very fact that we haven't found full contentment and happiness, which drives us on to the next life. And then we keep on doing the same thing again. And that life too ends in the same way. Not really fulfilled, not really happy, not really found those things that you thought you were going to find. And this is a very important reflection. It is important because we tend to feel, our life tend to feel purposeful. It tend to feel like they have a goal and have an aim. We tend to feel that we are, you know, if I do these things, I get a good education, I get the right job or whatever, then everything will be right. It won't be right. That's the whole problem. Yeah, it will still just carry on. It will still just get to that point and then you think, what now? And then you have to do something more. It just goes on. There is, that point never actually arises. So there is a delusion, very deeply rooted delusion in our minds that we will come to a point that there is a purpose to all of this. We are moving towards something when in fact, actually, it is not really the case. And this is another way of thinking about the world which turns you away from the external world because it actually is pointless. So you move to the inner life instead and you develop your mind. And when it comes to the development of the mind, there is actually a purpose. There is actually a point. It actually takes you to a conclusion. And this, of course, is precisely what the Buddhist path is all about. Yeah, so you, that is where you find that real meaning, that real purpose of life. So again, just one of those simple little phrases, you probably may not even have seen it if you had read it, but because I have read it in Pali and in various translations, I know the significance of some of these little simple phrases. So, and the reason we're still faring around in this way is by not understanding four things. And those four things are often said to be the Four Noble Truths. But here they are a different set. Here they are the noble morality, the Aryan, the Arya Sila, the Arya Samadhi, the Arya Panya, and the Arya Vimutti, wisdom and liberation. And the Aryan morality, the Aryan Sila, is the same thing I was just talking about before. When you are a stream enterer, morality becomes second nature to you. It becomes part of who you are. Why? Because you have understood existence. You know that if you're not moral, the only person you are hurting is yourself. You may be hurting others as well, but you're certainly hurting yourself by being immoral. You're the first person you hurt by living immorally. So because you have seen that fully, you can't be immoral anymore as an Aryan. Even mentally, you can't really carry ill will and desire around very, very much because you know the problem with those things. So you perfect morality, certainly outwardly, but even inwardly to a large extent. The Aryan stillness, this is the Arya Samadhi, and this is slightly different from the ordinary Samadhi. Ordinary Samadhi is often just defined as the four jhanas. But the Aryan Samadhi is the four jhanas that are imbued with and come together with the other seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Because the problem is that if you don't have right view, from a Buddhist point of view, there is no such thing as a creator God. Yeah, this is the Buddhist point of view. So if you believe in a creator God, and then you practice the samadhi in this way, then of course, once you get to the highest point of samadhi, you will see that creator God in that samadhi, because it will have those factors, those qualities that you think exist for a creator God. So you will misinterpret it. So the whole point of the Aryan samadhi is that it is the samadhi supported by the right view. So you start off with the idea that there is no such thing as a permanent essence in the world. When you come to samadhi, that too needs to be investigated. That too needs to be is subject to impermanence and suffering and non-self. So investigate it in that self, in that way. And that is the Aryan samadhi, where you understand samadhi in the right way, based on the right view, based on the other seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, so it's slightly different from ordinary samadhi. And this is why, as a Buddhist, you don't normally, there's usually no problem with samadhi, because you know that that is not the end of the path, and you have to go further. It's only if you have some kind of wrong view from a Buddhist point of view, that that is a problem. And then you have the Aryan wisdom, which of course is the wisdom of the stream entry, yeah, the full insight into reality, the Four Noble Truths that the stream entry has. And the Aryan liberation is the liberation that you have, especially when you become an arahant, the final vimutti, when you are liberated from suffering, you're liberated from the defilements, you're liberated from all these problematic things in the world. And then, so this is what you have to understand. And when you understand these things, then the cycle of rebirth comes to an end as a consequence. So, yeah, and then the Buddha says, and it is by understanding and penetrating these four, where did it go? Yeah, these four, that, and it is by understanding and penetrating these four, that the craving for existence has been cut off, the tendency towards becoming rebirth has been exhausted, and there will be no more rebirth. So this is the solution to the problem, is by attaining these four things and by penetrating and understanding what they are. The it says here the tendency of the craving for becoming, this is the bhava tanha, it literally means the craving for existence. I think that's a better translation, because I think it's more meaningful to say that we crave for existence rather than to say that we crave for becoming. I'm not really sure how you can crave for becoming, but we tend to crave for certain states. The tendency towards becoming has been cut off. The bhavanetti. Bhavanetti means, netti is like something that leads to something. That which leads to existence has been cut off. Really what that means. And there will be no more rebirth. There will be nothing more after this. That is the knowledge that arises because of that. And very lastly, let me just finish off with this last little verse here. Thus the Lord spoke. The welfare having spoken thus, the teacher said this. Morality, samadhi, wisdom, and final release. These, the famous Gautama came to know. The Dhamma he had discerned, he taught his monks. He whose vision ended suffering has gone to Nibbana. To Nibbana. So here he is just summarizing these things. It says here that this is spoken by the Buddha, but what is interesting about this little verse, it has all the characteristics of not being spoken to by the Buddha. It says here the famous Gautama, the Buddha never calls himself Gautama, he always calls himself Tathagata, yeah? And he doesn't really call himself famous. It says he's glorious, but really the word yasa means famous. And the last one, he's Parinibbuto, which usually means that he's gone to Nibbana. Usually means he's passed away. That's the usual meaning of that. The commentary defines it differently because it doesn't fit with the commentarial ideas. But to me, it looks like this was added by editors later on. And in fact, there are a number of verses in the later on here in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta that were added by editors. And it's obvious when you read them, and it's said so in the commentaries. And this one here, I think, is also one of those, even though it is here accredited to the Buddha. And what that means is that we sometimes have to be a little bit careful. Even when something is said to be said by the Buddha like this, it doesn't necessarily mean that is the case. Because these suttas have been edited a little bit after the Buddha passed away. And that editing is not always 100% reliable. And this is particularly important when we come to the next part of the sutta, which is the four great standards. And this is the standards on how to decide what is the word of the Buddha, how to collect the suttas, and how even in the present day we decide on the what we can take as the essence of the Buddha's teachings and what is not. So this is what comes up next. That is just a tiny little preview for you about what happens next. And that kind of relates to that issue. Okay, I'm going to stop there. Any more questions? Yes, we're talking here. Yeah.
So
Sakyamuni, yeah, it's not a very frequent term in the suttas. I think it occurs in a few times, usually in verses and that sort of thing. I would have to look it up for you. I can't really remember offhand, but I think it is a fairly rare term. But this is one of the things that often happen in the suttas, is that rare terms often get taken out of the suttas and then they get used in a new way in later Buddhism and they get expanded on. Yeah, this is kind of one of the characteristics of what happens. So like the Visuddhimagga, for example, is a classic example of that, which takes one fairly obscure sutta and make that becomes the edifice for the entire Visuddhimagga. And within the Visuddhimagga itself, the main way that it explains the first jhana practice is through the earth kasina, which is never really talked about at all in the sutta. So a lot of terms that occur rarely in the suttas and then used later. Or do they happen over a long-term period only? I presume you're talking about the sequences. Presumably you mean the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas that we talked about by the sequences, or do you mean the last sequence? You probably mean the first one, I would think. Can you see them? You don't really need to worry too much about seeing these things. You know, these things are practical applications of the path. It is more, it's important that you understand what they refer to. But in a sense, you do see them, in a sense that you start to understand what right application of effort means, for example, on the path. There's many ways of applying effort in the wrong way. That makes you kind of tired, you strive too hard, and you can't really let go properly. So there's many ways of using right effort in the wrong way. But right effort should really, ideally, be a matter of using wisdom. In other words, turning your mind in the right direction is really the right kind of effort. So in a sense, you learn about the factors in this way as you go along. Yeah, and then gradually it becomes clear to you what right effort means. Right mindfulness, the same kind of thing. Initially, you may not even have very strong mindfulness at all. And even the idea of mindfulness only gradually emerges as your meditation deepens and you see what happens. And then once you understand what mindfulness really is, you start to also understand the power of samadhi, because samadhi is often what powers that mindfulness and what enables that mindfulness to then break through and have a profound insight into reality. So yes, you do uncover these things gradually, it's true. It does not happen in a single retreat. It happens usually over a very long period of time, depending on where you start out, what is your basis and foundation, all of this. But even understanding morality fully actually is quite difficult, because morality goes very deeply, especially if you take into account the mental morality. It is a very deep and profound thing. And sometimes we don't know that there is something slightly, I shouldn't say immoral, doesn't sound right, but something that isn't fully moral yet inside of us. You haven't developed your morality fully. Sometimes you can't even see it. Yeah, you feel peaceful, you feel everything is fine, but maybe there's a little bit of attachment to the body there. That attachment to the body is a degree of lack of sila in Buddhism. It's not immoral as such, but it is something that blocks you from going further on the path, and as such it's a bad habit that you have to overcome. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. And let us just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.